Well, I'm humbled and honored to be with you here again this evening. I won't spend a lot of time talking about myself. I have a pretty little wife, and she's coming on Friday. And I think Mrs. Yoder hung a picture of my family on the bulletin board. I've been a lifelong farmer, other than the 7 years that my wife and I spent in Northern Ontario. She's Canadian. That's her home, Red Lake, Ontario. And we have 4 married children. When I was a little boy, we didn't fool around with this skimpy church stuff. We had 2 weeks of vacation Bible school, 2 weeks of revival meetings, and then George R. Brunk would come to town, and he did it for 6 weeks. And my dad, he was a big fan of going to church and tent meetings because we didn't have the internet and all these other cool things to do, you know. We went to church. But I remember as a little boy sometime those seats got hard. And so I'm going to tell the children something every evening so that you don't feel that you're sitting through 6 weeks of George R. Brunk's tent revivals. When I was a small boy, there was an evangelist came into our community. And I was born in Harrisonburg, Virginia area until I was 16. Well, I lived there until I was 16. And 1 year, there was a man came from Oregon, and his name was Marcus Lynn. And he wrote a book on the book of Romans. And it's the gold standard, in my opinion. And if you want to buy one, if you can find one, they're about $70, and he probably charged $2 for them back in the day. But Marcus Lynn was a Bible teacher in Oregon. And he had a children's class at our church when I was a small boy, and he told about his dad going to town to buy a new suit coat. And he found one, and when he got home, he opened this little pocket here that is worthless, totally worthless. And in it was a card that somebody had written with calligraphy, and it had this saying on it. And I want the children to listen because you need to say it tomorrow night for me. And so if you want to write it down or have your mother write it down or however you want to do it, that's up to you. What good will it do to smoke and to chew, to swear and to drink, and never to think what the end may be? Now, let's all say it together. What good will it do to smoke and to chew, to swear and to drink, and never to think what the end may be? Now, you have to be pretty old to have been tempted to smoke, because smoking is totally not cool anymore. I think there's some people that vape, but I'm not sure how that works. I really don't need to learn. But things change. And there was a lot of pressure on us in public school to hang out with the losers and smoke. But thank God I never did. But there's pressures on little children even in Christian schools. And maybe even the homeschool has some pressures on that need to be sanctified. And so remember, this man was probably born in the 1800s, and in his suit coat he found a card. What good will it do to smoke and to chew, to swear and to drink, and never to think what the end may be? So I'm going to let some person 12 or younger say that to me tomorrow night. You can stand up, and so you have something to look forward to. This evening, what I want to share is family-oriented. It's maintaining the right balance. And so I'm going to turn to a couple scriptures. You listen. You don't need to follow. You listen as I read, because I'm going to start in Deuteronomy chapter 6 and pick a few verses from a couple chapters. The first one is Deuteronomy, the first 12 verses. Now these are the commandments, the statutes, and the judgments which the Lord your God commanded to teach you, that you may do them in the land where you now go to possess it, that thou mayest fear the Lord thy God, to keep all of thy statutes and his commandments which I command thee, thou, thy son, and thy son's son, all the days of thy life, that thy days may go on and be prolonged. Hear therefore, O Israel, and observe to do it, that it may be well with thee, and that you may increase mightily, as the Lord God thy fathers has promised thee, in the land that floweth with milk and honey. And it goes on and on, and all these things, that if you listen to me, things will turn out good for you. And then in verse 12, then beware lest thou forget the Lord thy God, which brought thee forth out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. Beware lest you forget. That's like telling your children, did you remember what I told you? Or the school teacher, did you remember? And God says, don't forget what I told you. Chapter 7, verse 6. For you are a special and holy people unto the Lord your God. And the Lord your God has chosen you out of all the people on the face of the earth to be his people and his treasured possessions. Now the Lord did not set his affection on you and choose you because you were more numerous than other peoples, for you are the fewest of all people, but because the Lord loved you and kept the oath that he swore beforehand and redeemed you from the land of slavery, from the power of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. Know, therefore, that the Lord your God is God, and that he is a faithful God, keeping the covenant of his love, a thousand generations of those who keep his commandments. And now I'm going to go over to verse chapter 8. And when my children come home from wherever they are, and we sit down at Thanksgiving, they have to endure me reading these verses before they can eat Grace's Thanksgiving dinner. That's just part of it. Now when you have eaten and are satisfied, praise the Lord your God for the good land that he gave you. And be careful that you do not forget the Lord your God, failing to observe his commands, his laws, his decrees that I'm giving you today. Otherwise, when you eat and are satisfied, and when you build fine houses and settle down, and when your herds and flocks grow large, and your silver and gold increase, because you live in Indiana. I'm sorry. And all of you have multiplied, and when your heart will become proud, and you will forget the Lord your God. But remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you the ability to produce wealth, and so confirms his covenant, which he swore to your forefathers as it is today. If you ever forget the Lord your God and follow other gods and worship and bow down to them, I testify against you today that you will surely be destroyed like the nations the Lord destroyed before you. So you will be destroyed for not obeying the Lord. And God, he's not playing around. He said, you either obey or suffer the consequences. And what did they choose? I have reached the stage of life where my boys run the farm and I work for them. And it's a little awkward to have to go to your boys and ask to use the company credit card when you started it. I mean, like, but you'll get there too. And so a lot of what I've done the last couple years is run equipment, and so I work with a silage crew, and it's a good life. I ride around with all these young boys, and they're talking on the radio, and I pick on them, and they bring me food, and just sitting in the cab, and it's nice and cool, and it's hot outside. But from my view behind the windscreen, I made several observations one year. There were rabbits, and there were quail, and little wild turkeys hiding in the corn. And for a lot of years, there wasn't hardly any. When I was a boy, I used to raise quail and pheasants, and I still enjoy to hear that clear call, that unmistakable whistle of the male bobwhite in the spring when he calls his mate, and in the summer, just because he can. And the female has a distinct and lovely call as well. Quail are at the bottom of the food chain and often experience a high mortality rate, as high as 70 to 80%. Because they are prolific breeders and with optimum conditions, they can raise several broods a year. Y'all have quail here? Well, that's my point. Pre-1980, there were quail all over the lower South. But there's several things that brought pressure to bear, brought about the demise and almost a total collapse of quail populations in the Deep South and in North Florida. At the Edisto Research Station, Clemson University's experimental farm close to us, entomologist Jay Chapin says that quail are simply gone from the agricultural research facility. Chapin is an avid hunter and recalls the 80s when there was over 20 coveys at that facility, and now he says there's not one quail left. In 1978, coyotes were first spotted in the upstate of South Carolina. In the 40 years since, the coyotes have made all the counties of South Carolina their home, and there's nowhere has it been more noticeable than in the wildlife community. It has totally upset the balance of forest and field. You see, there needs to be a balance. There's a balance in creation. There needs to be a balance in your home. I'll get to that. The rabbits, the quail and turkey nests, and the little fawns are the first ones to fall prey to the coyotes. A few years ago, my boys hired a professional trapper, and he came into our community, and he spent some time the last few winters there working his art of craftiness against the coyotes. He didn't get them all, but he really sobered them up. And this past spring, as I was driving silage carts, I'd see all these little animals. And the spring, the does all had fawns by their side, and there were little rabbits and little turkeys, and things were getting back in balance. So much so that suddenly Grace, my wife, has become the old Mr. McGregor, as in the tale of Peter Rabbit. She planted her okra four times. The tomatoes and eggplants have the sides eaten out of the fruit. And there's baby rabbits running all through the pole beans and into the watermelon vines. And there's big rabbits come out of the hiding place at night and they graze off the southern peas, well, almost anything. And we tried hot pepper spray. And we tried hot lead. And they just seem to multiply like rabbits. Do y'all know about the rabbit plagues in Australia? One guy. He's just two guys. You don't know about the rabbit plagues of Australia? In 1858, you know, in the plagues of Egypt, there weren't rabbits. There was a lot of other things, but there wasn't no rabbits. In 1859, a man named Thomas Austin, who was a British man that had immigrated to Australia, he loved to hunt rabbits, and there was no rabbits in Australia, so he imported 12 pairs of rabbits from England. They came on the ship, and he raised these things and turned them loose, and boy, did they ever do the rabbit thing. Within a few years, 24 rabbits had turned into millions, and there, by 1920, less than 70 years after the introduction of the rabbit, The population in Australia ballooned to 10 billion rabbits. I don't know who counted them, but they said they had 18 to 30 little babies a year because they could have litters all summer. There was no cold time. And the rabbits just started on the eastern side, and they just ate their way across to Australia. So the Australian government decided that they're devastating all the grasslands where they grow cattle, and so they decided what they was going to do. And so between 1901 and 1907, the Australian government went on a big fence building project, and they started at the top coast and went all the way down to the south coast at Starvation Harbor and built a fence so the rabbits couldn't get through. Well, then there was rabbits got on the other side, so they built another fence. That first fence was 724 miles long. No, 1,138. It's the longest continuous fence in the world. Well, the second fence, they angled off, and it didn't go quite up to the top. And that one was 724 miles. And then the rabbits kept coming, and so they built a fence east and west. And the rabbits still got through. Some dug over and some jumped across when they were building it. And so in the 1950s, they found a virus in South America that affects only rabbits. So they got this virus and got the mosquitoes to carry it, and they flew in and bit the rabbits. And about 90% of the rabbits died, just dead rabbits everywhere. But mosquitoes don't go into the desert. And so the rabbits in the desert, they didn't get bit, and the ones that are on the edge of the desert got bit just enough to build immunity. And so that didn't work anymore. And so in 1995, they found something called rabbit hemorrhage disease. And there again, it only affects rabbits. And they got flies to carry that one. But the flies would go into the desert, but they wouldn't go into the jungle. And they still got rabbits. They've shot rabbits. They've trapped rabbits. And there's just no natural predators. Things have gotten sorely out of balance. If you travel from the little community where close to our farm, several Mennonite families there, and as you go up the road towards Denmark, that's our little town, there's a sign that's out by one of the Mennonite families that says rabbits for sale. And I'm guessing that many of y'all went through that stage of trying to help your children grow rabbits, to teach them responsibility. Well, that's not what happens. It teaches your children how they can lose money graciously. You see, in creation there was balance, and we are not told how God managed it before the fall, but one day when the little rabbits went to school, they figured it out really quickly that it wasn't going to be a lot of fun at recess playing with the fox and hawk children. I wanted to read you a little story after my Bible reading, and I neglected it, so I want you to listen, about imprinting children and the effect that a balance in your home has on children. And this was written by E.J. Swam in 1969. I was fortunate enough in having exposed to biblical teachings of non-resistance in my earliest memory. On approaching maturity, I endeavored to rethink these positions for myself, and this resulted in a staunch decision that I could not participate in any form of Army service. Early in the summer of 1918, the last year of World War I, I was drafted into the Canadian Army. Father and son walked solemnly the 2 miles to the railroad depot where we took the train to Hamilton. Our conversation was punctuated with periods of silence. At one point, Dad finally spoke. "I feel something this morning like Abraham must have felt on his way to Mount Moriah." Now, certainly, I could not be so immodest as to elevate my parent to the status of father of the faithful. I cannot, however, escape remembering his bravery and Christian fortitude as he faced the whole ordeal. One instance of his heroism may suffice. While doing the morning chores shortly before my departure, he directed the following conversation. "My boy, you shall soon be leaving me, and we cannot tell what the consequences will be. I want to ask you, if worse comes to worse, how is it with your soul?" To this, I took a rapid retrospective of my past and recalled the two crises in my spiritual life of which he was aware. There was my conversion at 12 years and my entire commitment to Christ at 19 years. All I said in reply was, "It holds good this morning." And now what followed was a bit dramatic. He put his bony left arm up around my neck and said, "My boy, I do not know how I will get along with you here on the farm with only one arm, but I want you to stand true to God and your convictions at any price, and I would rather get word that you were shot than to know that you compromised your position and disobeyed the Lord." Such rugged faith, such staunch belief produced a buoyancy in my soul that I needed, and I could never forget it. And then we went out into our granary and had a season of prayer together. What a prayer meeting that was. Now, I want to go back to the coil. Some years ago, I went to a seminar on conservation tillage. One was to learn, but we got points for our license to be able to spray. And so we had to attend some of these things. But I chose to take a workshop on quail. And, you know, the Bob White kind of quail. And they handed out all these nice brochures and how to get quail to come and be attracted to your place. And then they told us some of the studies and experiments they were doing. They would take college interns and take them into a hatchery where they're hatching these little quail. And 2 days before the quail eggs would hatch, they'd let the intern have to be there by the incubator, and they would chirp and whistle and make noises. And the little quails in the eggs could hear them. After they hatched, they would spend 5 days with their little quail chicks under a brooder, talking and whistling to them and getting them to be familiar with the sounds of their foster mom. On day 6, they would take them out into the fields, and these little quail chicks, or, you know, they're about that big, would follow these interns around. And so they would monitor them and see what they ate. They take fecal samples and see how many bugs and how many worms and what it was they were eating. And then they would spray across them with airplanes, all kinds of, to see why quail weren't surviving. And this thing of these students becoming mother quail is called imprinting. And so I want to ask, how are you and I imprinting the little ones that God has placed into our care? And so we need to maintain some balances in our homes. And the first one that is so important for little quail chicks is warmth. When a quail chick hatches, it's about the size of a little fuzz ball, the size of a dime or a nickel. And they are totally dependent on their mother for warmth at night or on cool and cloudy days. And much of the high-protein diet that they need is to grow flight feathers, not fat and not muscle. They need to grow feathers so they can fly away from danger. And so they don't eat seeds and grain and things that older quail. They have to have protein. Small children need a warm spiritual environment as well to be able to flourish and grow into healthy, balanced adults, both spiritually and emotionally. Yes, blankets are necessary too, but beyond that, a peaceful, loving environment, void of anger and sharp retort and criticism. No child should ever have to go to bed at night and wonder with the slightest doubt if they are loved, wanted, needed, or belong, and that their parents' love is all enduring. A wet and soggy spring, such as we had last spring, is very hard on quail chicks. That cold, wet blanket of criticism and fault-finding and anger towards our children will cause a lot of suffering and a high spiritual casualty rate as well. James 1:19. My dear brethren, or let's say fathers and mothers, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to learn, slow to speak, slow to become angry, for man's anger does not bring about the righteous life that God desires. Ephesians 6:4. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up into training and instruction of the Lord. All right, warmth. The second thing, little quail need cover. Like I told you, an adult quail's diet consists almost entirely of seeds and grain. A quail chick must have a diet of almost total insects for protein. The only way for that little chick to survive from the claws and teeth of all the hawks, bobcats, coyotes, is to either have safe places where predators can't get them or to be able to suddenly fly away. So their favorite habitat is blackberry brambles, tall stemmy weeds and flowers, ragweed, sunflowers, and black-eyed Susans. Border or filter strips between the cotton and peanut fields where the bugs grow and the brambles where they live. I want to tell you this evening that there's a world of jackals and vultures that would be very happy to feed on your little ones out scratching for the bugs that we all need without the cover provided for of a godly home and a spiritually sound, disciplined church community. It is difficult, with almost impossible, to raise children outside of a home, a church, and a community, and expect any level of success. I have a close relative that adopted a girl from Kazakhstan who spent 5 years in a bed in an orphanage. Poor child is emotionally messed up. She's 20 years old now and still emotionally messed up about an 8-year-old that she was never loved, just shoved a bottle. That's all she knew. If only she'd had a mama quail to warm her and scratch for bugs, and things little children need. But Gabby will always be handicapped. Scientists and wildlife biologists suggest that the lack of good cover and fence row to fence row tillage practices in the later part of the 20th century has had as negative effect on quail populations as coyotes. And so in the last 20 to 30 years, there's been a significant increase in no-till or strip-till farming, and that has been helpful in restoring nesting in safe places. Now, I read you those verses in Deuteronomy at the beginning of my sermon, and it is a responsibility of godly parents to provide the cover needed to protect the innocent and impressionable little ones that are placed into our care. It help your children make good choices and maintain healthy friendships. Influence is so huge, especially at those adolescent and teen years. You know, a child gets to be about 14. They care more what their friends think than what mom and dad think, and they're not trying to be disrespectful. It's just, you know, you're just not as cool as you used to be. At least that's kind of how it is, right? Sorry. Teach your children to be polite and courteous and friendly to all, but closer friendships where they find their approval and fulfillment in their social lives should be chosen carefully. I went to public school. And there was the involvement of the sports program and all the stuff that was offered. And my parents saw that we went to school, did our homework, and we came home. We didn't socialize there. We knew who we were. It was us and them. There wasn't this big melting pot. I can think of none of my peers that married town girls. But when you go to these liberal schools, church schools, you know, they're just, you know, we're Christians too, and it isn't long. You're not sure who your grandchildren are going to be. When my boys were adolescents, young teens, it became very fashionable to go coon hunting. And I never did it because I was a dairy farmer and I had to get up at 4 in the morning, and so who wants to come dragging in at 2 in the morning and then go out to the barn at 4? And I don't have a problem with coon hunting. Who wants to wade out in that snake and alligator water in the dark and shoot coons out of trees? But it's okay. But it brings such a tacky crowd. I mean, they're rough people and bad language, and they dip and they chew and all those things Marcus Lynn said you shouldn't do. But you see, those guys have the dogs. And so you got to go with the people with the dogs. And so I had an employee working for me who was about 20, and he got caught up in this coon hunting. But he was a responsible guy. He's now my co-pastor. And I said, Gordon, what if I would buy you a coon hound, and then you would take my boys hunting? That way I'd know who they was with. And I paid $750 for a coon hound so that I knew who my boys were with in the swamp. I learned that from my dad. Now, in Virginia, about this time of year, maybe it's February, it's still cold. The suckers migrate up the little streams to spawn, and they hang around at the bottom and rest, and they run up these rapids. And there's a season for dip netting, where you put this net out there and below the rapids, and then you lift it, and you'd get gunny sacks full of suckers. And it was really a lot of fun for 12 and 14-year-old boys, but there again, the riffraff of society was into that. And so finally my dad and the late Simeon Heatbowl, who I was friends with his boys, they worked it out that we couldn't drive, and so we would drive a tractor and a manure spreader and put our gear in the manure spreader and go dipping. That way they could say when we needed to be home. We couldn't say, well, we were with so-and-so, and they didn't come home till midnight. And so they weren't against what we wanted to do. They were concerned about the predators that were going to feed on us. Be diligent and engaged and involved in your children's lives, especially during those impressionable years. You know, daycares is a wonderful way of imprinting other people's children for good. But as a general rule, it's a terrible way to raise your children. If you want to provide daycare for non-Christian children, it's a ministry. But don't let them raise your children. On the flip side, we've been through the patriarchal movement. Maybe it's still alive and well. I'm not in school anymore. And it's the approach where you know, daddy knows best, and daddy's going to baptize you, and daddy's going to marry you, and we don't want the preacher speaking into your life too much. Daddy knows everything, and that's nonsense. Daddy needs all the help he can get. We do well to seek the support and help of others, the Christian school, the local church. They help us provide the cover we need to raise a brood of children for Jesus. I taught Bible school for many years, and I had a student one time call me up. She's about 19 years old, and she lived way out west. And she called me up, and she was having romance problems. And she had a guy that wasn't going good, and she kind of liked him, but there was some problems. And I told her, I says, well, you have a daddy, and you need to ask your dad if it's okay if you talk to me. I'm not your daddy, but you know, I have my opinions. And so she did, and the daddy called me up, and he says, I want you to know you have my full support, and that it takes a bigger village than just me to raise quality young. I was so blessed. I felt the freedom to talk into that girl's life. She's married to somebody else. She's thriving. She's doing well. But the dad was humble enough to say, I can use your help. You've been before me. And so I felt honored. One of the best forms of cover for protecting your family is consistent family devotional time and prayer. Remember, influence is huge. Give your children the gift of a daily time together with God. It should be the anchor that starts or closes each day. You take the pick, morning or evening. I'm going to tell you, family devotions is never convenient. It is a discipline, and there will be plenty of reasons and excuses to challenge its existence. We are not a generation of farmers anymore. Is there any farmers in this church? Oh, thank the Lord. I grew up many generations of farmers. We went out and did the chores, came in and ate breakfast and had family devotions. And my children do that. My daughter married a guy that runs a big business. He's out of the house at 4, and well, they have family devotions at night, but now they got teenage children, and well, they got to go to youth, they got to go to choir practice, and good luck with that. So, most of us are not farmers anymore. Dad gets up and goes to work, the teenage boys go to work somewhere else, and the teenage daughters may help mom, but they may work at the greenhouse or the grocery store or whatever. And so Ernest Hostetler told me what he did. He's the former bishop of the Beachy Church in Abbeville, South Carolina. And he said when his children got to be teenagers, they scattered. And he gave up on having at night because there was always something going on. So he sat down with these children and said, Let's talk about this. So, what if we all get up at 5 in the morning? Because I'm going out the house at 6, and your brother's going out at 6, but we're going to different places. And it was mostly girls. He says, you all don't have to be dressed for the day, but could you come down modest, and we'll have family devotions at 5 in the morning. And then if y'all want to go back to bed, whatever. That way me and your brother could leave. And they agreed. And he said it was such a blessing that they, after they did it a little while, that they really look forward to their family devotions. Because dad and mom made the commitment to see that it happens. Mark 1:35, very early in the morning, a great while before day, he went to a solitary place and prayed. Psalm 5, verse 3. My voice shalt thou hear in the morning, O Lord. In the morning will I direct my prayer unto thee and will look up. For thou art not a God that hath pleasure in wickedness, neither shall evil dwell with thee. I want to suggest this evening that God is not a God of performance. He is just seeking worshipers. John chapter 4, verse 23, "But the hour cometh," he's talking to the Samaritan lady, or the woman at the well. Was she Samaritan? I think so. Well, anyway, the woman at the well, all right? "But the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and truth." Listen to this. "For the Father seeketh such to worship him." In all other religions, people are seeking a God to worship. But in the Christian faith, God is seeking those who will worship him. Don't let him down. Try to keep your family devotions from being boring. Ask the children questions. Read a more flowable translation if you care to. Read Bible stories. Good missionary stories. When our children got to be 8, 9 years old, we started reading missionary biographies. And Youth with a Mission has paperbacks. They must have 100 of them. Anybody from Jim Elliot to... There's no Anabaptist people in there, I don't think. But there was only 2 of them that were a little bit disappointing to me. And we read these stories, and we read all of Pablo Yoder's books. And don't you know, 2 of our boys ended up in Nicaragua. And read your children's story. Yeah, we read the Bible too, but make your family devotions interesting. You don't need to read stories. But if you got little children, do something that they look forward to that time. And they should ask you what's wrong when you skip. I want to read you a story. "Do us faithfully whatever thou doest." 3 John 5. Timid and modest Christians sometimes omit family devotions in the presence of distinguished visitors, and it is a sore trial for a Christian mother to maintain a family altar and to lead the devotion before strangers. The following incident may stimulate some fainting heart to fidelity. 10 years ago, when an unconverted man, I boarded in the family of a pious woman whose husband was not a Christian. There was a daughter of 19, another of 14, and a son of 10. Every morning after breakfast, I heard that humble woman gather her family in the kitchen and read with them a chapter in the Bible. And then, as I could not help listening, there was a peculiarity of service which mystified me. At last, one day, I asked if I might remain. She hesitated. Her daughter blushed, but said that I could do so if I really desired it. And I sat down with the rest of the family, and they gave me a testament, and we all read. And then, kneeling on the floor, that mother began a prayer audibly for her dear ones, her husband, and herself, and then, pausing a moment as if to gather her energies or wing her faith, uttered a tender and compassionate supplication for me. She closed, and her daughter began to pray. Poor girl, she was afraid of me. I was from college, and I was her professor. But she tremulously asked for a blessing as usual. And then came the other daughter, and then at last the son, the youngest of that circle, who only repeated the Lord's Prayer and with one petition of his own. His amen was said, but no one arose. And I knew on an instant that they were waiting for me. And I, poor prayless me, had no word to say. It almost broke my heart, and I hurried from the room. A few weeks only passed, and I asked their permission to come in once more. And then I prayed too. And I thanked my ever-patient Savior for the new hope in my heart and the new song on my lips. And it is a great thing to remember that there in the gospel was in the law provision made not only for thy son, thy daughter, and thy maidservant, thy manservant, but also for thy stranger within the gates. And now finally, food. To be successful at raising her chicks to where they can live independently, Mama Quail has to find lots of food, and not just any food will do. And like I told you before, the quail chick needs to eat its weight in insects every day to grow flight feathers. And those of you who raise boys can identify. Mealtime is when boys come to the table and continue to eat. Are we as careful and as consistent in providing spiritual food for those young ones in our care? Grace and I have an acquaintance who constantly obsesses about the type of healthy, crunchy foods that her children have access to. But that same mother will push her high chairs in front of the T&V when she finds them in her way or seemingly has little or they're around her feet, and she has little or no concern about the spiritual nutrition that feeds their young minds. Those children are in their upper 20s now. One is vegan. The other one may be pretty healthy too, but spiritually it's been a disaster. It is very important that you not only know where your children are feeding, but who with and what they're actually feeding on. There are probably more changes in the advances of science and medicine and travel and communication in the last 20 years than in the last 100 years previous to that. And one of the change beginning of the 21st century has been the internet. And I'm not going to belabor that point. You know, it's here to stay, and it has many useful purposes. Grace and I raised our family almost pre-digital revolution and the age of the internet. Our oldest son was killed, but he dated his girlfriend with letters. Carla and Jason wrote a bit, and they text and had phone conversations. I pled with my children to write letters, and you're such an old fuddy-duddy. Nobody does that anymore. But I had a nice stack of papers that smelled so good and had nice handwriting on them. But anyway, what's a text? Our third son and his girlfriend text some and emailed some, but invested heavily in jet fuel. She lived in Nevada. Joel and Jody were the fourth, and I think they pretty much went paperless. Then our youngest son, Aaron and Andrea, through the wonders of the internet, could have audio and visual and be 3,000 miles apart. He had one date before he went to Nicaragua, came home in 2 years, and got married. Saved all that money. But I don't recommend it, but it's what worked for them. Is it wrong? No, but there are dangers in most every way. There are challenges to good parenting in my childhood, in my grandfather's, and biblical times. They're not going away, just different problems. Parenting has never been for sissies or the faint-hearted. So parents of young children this evening, take courage. It's not that God has not made provision. It's just there's different challenges, and sin has become so convenient, so available, so private, and so raw. We used to have to, if we wanted to look at something that was not appropriate, you had to go find it at a store, and then the shame of having to get it and pay for it. Well, we didn't do it. There was a lot of deterrence, and now people have access to all kinds of nastiness on their phones. You know these things. You know the time of Esther. Esther called her out. I'm not going to read the story. It's in my notes here. But she was hesitant at first to listen to her uncle about going to see the king. The consequences could be very bad. He could take her life. And then her uncle said this, And who knows but that you have been come to royal position for such a time as this? And she said, Uncle Mordecai, I will do it. You pray and I will go. It was a very difficult time in the history of God's people. But I think there were godly families who lived in times of war. I read about this boy that got marched into World War I. There was no provision for conscientious objectors. A difficult time. Persecution or extreme hardship. Your adversary is much more cunning and sly tonight. And the enemy is not so clearly defined as maybe it was in past generations. It's not that new sins have been invented. If you read the book of Judges, it's just like, whoa, it's terrible. But what has changed is the easy access to those sins and temptations. So practically speaking, the availability of the internet in our homes and phones hasn't brought a mass exodus of the faithful from our churches. I don't think it has. Sudden tragic failures have happened. We all know of examples. But most of the negative effects in our families will likely be much slower and much more subtle, more sneaky. For those influences to blow us off course don't necessarily require us to go over into the bad part of the internet. May the day never come when we realize that a brother or sister who embraced a strong faith has quietly shed key basic principles of Christianity. And maybe the youth have lost sensitivity towards violence, or our brotherhood becomes acclimated to sinful lifestyles and choices. Perhaps today will come, and may have already is here, when young children will receive their Bible instruction from silly animated cartoons, but none from their father. Failing to choose carefully and chart a time-tested course in long voyages does not prevent your ship from leaving shore. But it is the danger of an uncertain destination. The helpful winds of brotherhood may carry us to intended harbor and destination, but probably we will end up dashed on the rocks of remorse and disappointment if we allow poor vision and certain influences from the internet to creep in and change us. 1 Peter 5:8, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion or that sneaky coyote, walketh about seeking whom he will devour. May God give you wisdom. I had a story I wanted to read, but it's time to close. And so thank you for your attention. Let's pray, and then I'll turn the time over to Brother Yoder.